Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The planet's vital signs looking pretty good in the near term. However, the big picture shows a growing food shortage crisis, a report from World Watch Institute. And Zero Population Growth, the organization, out with a children's stress index.
The message of the report is that people are part of the problem, part of the solution. The reason that our communities got into this mess in the first place was essentially because of people making some, not so good decisions, being too obsessed with growth and the short-term gain without looking at the long-term pain.
The Environment Show, a national production, made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. The parable of Jesus feeding the 4,000 with 7 loaves of bread and just a few fish comes to mind as we consider a recent report from World Watch Institute. Only in this case, says Institute President Lester Brown, we will not have enough bread or fish, and there may be many more indeed than 4,000. In the 1993 edition of Vital Signs, an annual publication from World Watch, Brown tracks what he sees as the most critical of our environment's vital signs, namely population growth and food supplies to sustain us. In short, neither calculation looks very good.
Perhaps the most important finding of Vital Signs 1993 is that the growth in world population is overwhelming each of the three major food-producing systems, that is, oceanic fisheries, rangelands, from which we get most of our beef and mutton and some of the other livestock products, and croplands, which we depend on for our staple food, grain, wheat or rice or corn, depending on where we live in the world.
Consider first the bounty from the sea. Brown says we took 22 million tons of fish from the sea in 1950. World population at the time was around 2.5 billion. By 1989, when the world's population had nearly doubled to 5.2 billion, we were taking 100 million tons of fish from the sea per year. Says Brown, this meant that per capita consumption of fish went from 9 kilograms in the 1950s to 19 kilograms in 1989. It would seem plenty of fish and seafood to go around. However,
then, after 1989, the catch dropped off. It was 97 million tons last year. The marine biologists at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, who track oceanic fisheries and gather the data on the catch from each of them, have been saying for some time now that they did not think the world catch could go beyond 100 million tons, at least not on a sustained basis. And the trend of the last few years suggests that they are probably right. If so, then as long as population growth continues, the per capita seafood supply will diminish.
As world population continues to climb, doubling in less and less time, with projections of 19 billion by the middle of next century, there will be fewer and fewer of us able to eat sufficiently from the sea. Brown sees the per capita consumption being cut in half back to the 1950s level in the next four decades. As rapidly as our harvest has climbed, so it will decline. We face a similar situation on land.
One of the things that became clear this year is that the other major natural system on which we depend for animal protein, namely the world's rangelands, which are roughly double in area the world's croplands, that we're reaching the limits on these on these at about the same time as we are with oceanic fisheries. Most of the world's beef and most of the world's mutton comes from grazing on these rangelands. And we now find that on every continent, rangelands are being pushed to their limit and beyond. They're being overgrazed more often than not. And you see this if you traipse around Africa, for example, or if you go about India or China, certainly in the Middle East, where much of the forage that existed there a few generations back is now largely gone because of overgrazing. The world's rangelands simply can't support ever larger herds of cattle and flocks of sheep and goats. They've pretty much had it at this point. World beef production has not increased at all in the last few years, and in per capita terms, it's been declining for some time. So somewhat ironic, and importantly, for these two major sources of animal protein, we're sort of reaching the limit at the same time.
Brown says we are reeling from a 1-2 punch as we lose rangeland, grazing land. We are also losing cropland, this due to urban sprawl and changes in water supply for irrigation. Not only are we losing land for crops to feed the animals, hay and grains, we are also losing land once planted with crops for human consumption.
The net effect of this has been to slow the growth in the world grain harvest rather dramatically. From 1950 to 84, it was expanding by 3% a year, much faster than population, leading to a 40% increase in the amount of grain per person during that 34-year span. But since 1984, the growth in grain output has also dropped well below population, with the result that between 84 and 1992, there was a 9% decline in per capita grain output.
Of course, all of this is very much related to the growth in population, not only in actual numbers, but in the rate at which those numbers are being added. Comment on that. I want to tie that into what we've discussed so far about the food supply.
What we are now discovering is that with the much slower growth in the various sources of food, whether it be seafood or livestock products or grain or what have you, that we can now satisfy the needs for the 91 million people being added each year only by reducing average consumption among those already here. And this is a new situation. This is what distinguishes the current era from the most of the four decades since mid-century. When we look at the number being added, the 91 million, it's difficult for us to relate to it. It's such a large number. It is equal to the population of the United Kingdom, plus Norway, plus Denmark, plus Belgium, for example. Each year, we have to feed that many more people. Or another way to look at it, it's another New York City every month.
If population trends and crop loss rates both continue, the 300,000 starvation deaths we witnessed in Somalia in 1992 will be seen as minor losses compared to the numbers we will lose in coming decades.
In terms of world population growth, the 300,000 lives were equal to 29 hours of world population growth.
As deeply concerning as these vital signs are, Brown reports some good news as well. He says worldwide production of chlorofluorocarbons has dropped 50% in the last 4 years, and this is good news for the atmosphere and our lungs. There are other developments we should note, says Brown.
One of the little-known trends in the United States is the enormous growth in bicycle production over the last couple of decades. In 1992, world bicycle production reached 100 million. That compares with 35 million automobiles, and it clearly establishes the bicycle as the world's leading form of personal transportation.
To those living in the Western Hemisphere, say on Main Street of any town, USA, this must seem an odd, if not inaccurate, statement. However, consider China, where the ratio of bicycles to cars is 250 to 1. Now the statement seems plausible. On the larger energy front, Brown says 1993 may spell the beginning of the end of fossil fuel consumption, that is. Coal production is down, oil production is down, nuclear capacity is leveling off, renewables are on the rise. In fact, Brown detects great changes in the wind.
Technological advances over the last couple of years have greatly increased the efficiency of wind turbines and blades, making them much more cost competitive. Indeed, in many areas of the United States, wind power is now becoming competitive with coal, with coal-fired electricity. So as the Clean Air Act begins to take effect in stages during the 1990s, I think we're going to see a substantial shift from coal to wind power.
While we associate wind power with places such as California and in Europe, Denmark, Brown says wind-generated energy is now possible in many other regions.
In the United States, the most recent national survey of wind resources indicates that using the new technologies, North Dakota and South Dakota together have enough wind energy potential to satisfy U.S. electricity needs with some to spare. In Europe, England and Scotland have enough wind potential to satisfy half the electricity needs of Europe.
These are some of the hopeful signs indicating our awareness and action. But taken together, the critical and the hopeful vital signs, which is more significant?
In doing vital signs, I have myself learned a lot about what is happening in the world. It's been an extraordinarily educational experience. It was only in doing vital signs that I realized that population growth was overrunning all three of the world's major food systems. It was in doing vital signs that I realized that it was likely that the growth in wind electric generation during the 90s would exceed the growth in nuclear electric generation. But as I look at the global trends and realize that we're not making much progress in slowing population growth, I'm beginning to be concerned about the future.
Brown says we only have a few years to make some serious changes in our population growth rates and in some of the other areas where we are adversely affecting our planet. The book is Vital Signs, compiled by Lester Brown, president, and a team of researchers from World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. Vital Signs is available from W.W. Norton. This is Bruce Robertson. You know how to save for a rainy day? How about saving on a rainy day? That's what Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says he does. In fact, he says he saves the rain itself. It's not a new technique, he says, but there is a new way to go about it.
Oh, there's Larry. What are you doing?
Bruce, hi, how are you
doing? Looks like you're getting ready to wash your clothes in an old wash barrel.
Well, this is an old wash tub. It's about a 20 or 30 gallon wash tub that actually I found in the basement of my old house. And I've decided to start harvesting rainwater this summer. And I've just placed this barrel in my backyard right underneath the downspout of my guttering system. So every time it rains, I could get 20 or 30, this thing could fill up. I could get 20 or 30 gallons of rain. And, you know, as we get into a drier seasons, wherever you live, you could always be getting into a drier season. There's no reason why you shouldn't collect this valuable natural resource, which then you can use to water your flowers and water your garden, and you won't have to put any strain on your city's, you know, your municipal water system.
Of course, rainwater has been a source of drinking water and washing water for a very long time.
Well, since before the Romans, at least, and I know that I lived in a house in Spain and I lived in a house in central Missouri that we had cisterns, and that's the La Cisterna. That's the old way of collecting rainwater because you can't drill wells. And I lived in a rainwater house for two or three years of my life, so I found it to be a perfectly good way of doing it.
I see next to you something very interesting. It's a barrel of sorts.
Yeah, well, this is the more high-tech, modern way of going about this. This is a big old pickle barrel. Hello down there. Anybody in there? Well, you can hear that this is about a 55, 60-gallon barrel, and this is a bona fide rain barrel that I got from the Great American Rain Barrel Company in Boston, Massachusetts. And this is a hard plastic 55-gallon drum that it's recycled. It's an old pickle barrel, an old olive barrel, or something like that, that I'm also going to hook up to my house. And then I can really collect a lot of rain, 50 gallons, 60 gallons. And then I also have these connector tubes. So I could get a whole series of these, and anybody who wanted to do this could have a whole series of these. That these connector tubes are just little tubes. Almost all of these barrels have holes drilled in them, or you can drill a hole into the side of the barrel and just hook the tube up to it. And as this barrel fills up, then the water will spill over into another barrel and another barrel and another barrel.
Successively on down the line, right.
That's right, and you can actually build up some water pressure with these, and I've got a spigot that can go right into the side of this. Turn the spigot on just like an ordinary spigot, and you can get a little water pressure. You can either put it into a bucket that you want to use, or you can hook your hose up to it. So you can, you know, maybe not too far from your house, you could water the flowers with your hose right there.
Well, Larry, get back to your rain barrel. Yeah. Call down your rain barrel. Remember that old song, Call Down My Rain Barrel?
Hello down there.
Sounds
so
good.
Hopefully that'll be all filled up and we won't get that
we'll
echo
get
before
echo.
Too long.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care.
Right,
see you next time.
Thanks for coming by.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His rain barrel stands at the corner of his house in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. America's children are stressed. Hidden beneath the more commonly recognized pressures of growing up loom the challenges of population growth and overconsumption. This according to an extensive study recently released by the Washington, D.C.-based organization Zero Population Growth. The group's Children's Stress Index documents how population impacts the well-being of children. Using population-related social, economic, and environmental indicators, the study ranks the best and worst places for American children to live. Jim Ormond has more.
The future population will, in many ways, determine the kind of quality of life that our children will be living on a day-to-day basis in 50 or 60 years.
So says Diane Sherman of the Washington, D.C.-based organization Zero Population Growth. Currently, 5.5 billion people inhabit Earth. Projections for growth range from 8 billion to nearly 20 billion by the middle of the next century. However, even the most conservative estimates are cause for alarm.
When you consider that the current population of the world has already been enough to decimate rainforests, have show a rate of extinction we've never seen before, create desperate water problems all over the country, all over the world, including in this country, there's crowded pressures on being able to provide education and jobs and shelter and welfare for these billions more people. So these alternative scenarios between 8 billion people and 19 billion or more in the next century will have enormous impacts on almost all dimensions of what we consider quality of life.
While it is true that the fastest growth rates are occurring in India, some African nations in Central America, the United States' borders are not immune to the problem and its effects.
Here at home, within our own borders, the Census Bureau's latest projections show that our population, too, could either stabilize at about another 30 million more people than we have today within our children's lifetime, or, in fact, it could nearly double. And when you are considering here that there are a little bit more hidden population pressures, but nonetheless, they're impacting our own quality of life by increasing traffic congestion, overdevelopment. Our water supplies are becoming more and more polluted, including our favorite oceans as great escapes. Our national parks are becoming crowded and overpolluted, and wildlife is disappearing. We are experiencing water shortages. We're running out of space to put our garbage. The litany of population pressures goes on and on.
To compile the Children's Stress Index, Zero Population Growth examined over 800 regions nationwide. Though some peaceful hamlets of yesteryear still exist, relentless population growth is stressing children in the U.S., especially in large metropolitan areas. In fact, says Sherman,
there was a direct correlation between the size of the city and the amount of stress on children. In other words, the larger the area, like Houston and Los Angeles and Miami, the greater numbers of pressures on children because of the numbers of people crowding the streets, polluting the air, crowding into schools, and so on. These all translate into just general community-wide stress on children as compared to smaller kind of hometowns that we remember as children. Even the suburbs are getting crowded now, but when we were growing up that had safe streets, lots of parks and green space, and we kids didn't really have to worry about crime or terrible rates of pollution. So things have changed greatly, although there are still some small areas in America that are still what we remember as what America was all about. And indeed, some large cities, like San Francisco, have done a better job than other large cities at balancing economic growth and population growth with quality of life measures, and they scored relatively well on our study.
In fact, San Francisco rounds out the list of the top 25 best metro areas, with Burlington, Vermont, and Fargo-Moorhead, North Dakota, Minnesota, topping the list. Overland Park, Kansas, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, head the list of the best individual cities. On the list of worsts, Houston, Texas, for metro area, and Newark, New Jersey, worst individual city. Sherman says children were both the subject and the impetus for the study.
Children, unfortunately, have very little political voice, yet they are incredibly involved, concerned, and aware of the problems around them. ZPG has an educational program, and we receive probably about 30 or 40 letters and even more phone calls on a daily basis from children in all parts of the country who are concerned about things like teen pregnancy, crime on the streets and in the schools, overcrowding, unsafe recreational areas if they even have them left, if they haven't been taken over by development or roads. They're very concerned, as we all know, about saving the planet or about just improving the environment in their own neighborhoods. And they're writing to us for help. And we hope that indeed this Children's Stress Index will help alert both our parents as well as our neighbors, as well as our community's policymakers, to take action on behalf of children.
Sherman says it is clear from letters and interviews, children are concerned about their future, concerned that adults may not be doing their part right now to ensure a safe and healthy future for their communities. As for the ZPG prescription, Sherman says an ounce of prevention now will avert a pound of trouble in the future.
ZPG, of course, advocates overall a national population policy that will allow our nation's government to basically plan for people, to allow us to avert any severe problems that have to do with an imbalance between population and resources. Already we are reaching crisis stage in some areas like the Southwest that are experiencing severe water shortages at a time that they are increasing population at a very rapid rate. We are seeing national parks being decimated by too many people and human encroachment along the borders of national parks. There are a lot of things, garbage crisis and so on, again, the list goes on and on. A national population policy would allow forecasting, essentially. So hopefully we could plan better for larger populations and perhaps even encourage a stable population, as the administration under President Nixon did some 20 years ago.
Sherman hopes a heightened public awareness of these problems will lead to a more pragmatic policy in the future.
The message of the report is that people are part of the problem, part of the solution. The reason that our communities got into this mess in the first place was essentially because of people making some, you know, not-so-good decisions, being too obsessed with growth and the short-term gain without looking at the long-term pain or without balancing it with quality of life concerns like education and access to health care and environmental quality. And so those, you know, trends can all be reversed in communities all across this country, and that's what's exciting about it. And the decisions that we make today, the collective decisions that we make today, will essentially determine to a large degree what our children's future will look like.
Diane Sherman, Communications Director of Zero Population Growth. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. This is Jim Ormond.
We really do have the potential to make things much, much better for our children and future generations as well.
Thanks much, Jim, for that report. Well, that's it on the Environment Show this week. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. ask for The Environment Show, program number 186. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.